From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. How did two MIT graduates become the car guys? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Tom and Ray Malyatsi, the hosts of NPR's Car Talk. Listeners tune in not just for the information, but for the laughs. We'll also hear about Tom and Ray's first time behind the wheel, their first garage, their first radio show, and their relationship as brothers. Tom and Ray Malyatsi, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The U.S. has expressed regret for the apparent death of a Chinese fighter pilot in a mid-air collision with a U.S. surveillance plane on Sunday. But Washington refuses to apologize, as China demands. The 24-member U.S. crew survived the collision and is being held in what China describes as protective custody. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Each government blames the other for the collision, which occurred off the Chinese coast. The U.S. says it took place in international airspace. China does not agree. The U.S. continues to demand the release of the crew and the return of the aircraft. Each day that the 24 crew members are detained ups the ante in terms of anti-China sentiment in Washington. On Capitol Hill, some angry members of Congress threatened to revoke China's preferential trading status. The annual decision on that issue comes up in June. Secretary of State Colin Powell has issued a statement of regret for the loss of the Chinese pilot. He says the U.S. is using every available avenue to talk to Beijing so that each side can present explanations of the tragedy. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Britain today crossed the watershed of 1,000 confirmed cases of foot and mouth disease, but the government says the number of new cases has flattened out. From London, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Prime Minister Tony Blair told Parliament that the government's approach, which includes the army burying thousands of animals, is bearing fruit. While it was too early to say that the disease had plateaued, Blair said the acceleration of cases has slowed. Just 2 weeks ago, the country's chief scientist warned that unless the government improved the time it took to diagnose and slaughter infected animals, as many as half of Britain's livestock would have to be killed. The scale of the outbreak has forced Blair to postpone the local election and, by implication, a general election until June. Large tracts of the British countryside have been placed off limits, an effective quarantine that is expected to cost the country's tourism industry that thrives in the spring upwards of $1 billion. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, London.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan today warned lawmakers not to create new trade barriers. He said protecting American goods from imports would hurt the U.S. economy. Greenspan said the recent removal of many trade barriers is one major reason for the country's recent prosperity. The Fed chief also warned that economic progress could be endangered by new barriers thrown up by Congress. Technology stocks fell today amid relentless fears about the economy. Blue chips registered some gains as investors hunted for good buys in the depressed stock market. The Dow Industrials closed up by 30 points, ending the day at 95.15. The Nasdaq Composite was down 35 points, finishing at 16.38. Advancers led decliners, but stock trading was even, 1.4 billion shares. This is NPR News. NASA says it will live within budget restrictions proposed by the White House, but that will mean cuts in the International Space Station program. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The space agency recently announced it's $4 billion over budget for space station construction. This is far from the first cost overrun for the station, and it led House Science Committee Chairman Sherwood Bowler to ask whether NASA needed to design more realistic budgets.
I sometimes get the feeling that they... Part of the uniform at NASA includes rose-colored glasses, and I hope the rose-colored glasses are off now.
NASA Chief Dan Golden told the committee he's working to cut costs, but the Bush administration says NASA will have to eliminate parts of the station. That will mean the station will only accommodate 3 astronauts instead of 7 at a time. Some members of Congress say they're worried that will limit the value of the station. They urge the agency to find other ways to stay on budget. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
A Cook County, Illinois jury today found a 29-year-old man guilty of sexually assaulting, beating, and trying to kill a 9-year-old child known as Girl X. Patrick Sykes showed no emotion as the verdicts were read. Post-trial hearings are set for May. The girl is now 13 years old. The attack in the Cabrini Green housing project left her blind, in a wheelchair, and unable to speak. She testified in the trial by raising her head and moving her eyes. Visteon, the auto parts supplier spun off last year by Ford, said today it will cut 1,800 jobs in a restructuring push. The company said it wants to pare overhead costs and to improve customer service. Visteon's worldwide workforce numbers 82,000. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novosoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at SaabUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Listeners tune in to NPR's Car Talk, not just to diagnose their car troubles. In fact, some of the listeners don't even drive. Car Talk is one of NPR's most popular shows because it makes people laugh. It even makes Tom and Ray Maliazzi laugh, and they're the hosts of the show. They also write a syndicated column and are the authors of the book In Our Humble Opinion. Car Talk fans may still not be sure how these two MIT graduates became the car guys. After graduating MIT, Tom worked in the marketing department of a corporation, speculating about trends of the future. But he abandoned the corporate life to happily collect unemployment insurance. Ray, who was 12 years younger, had moved to Vermont after graduation, where he taught at a middle school. Ray says his mother urged him to try and rescue Tom from his layabout life. Ray returned to Boston, and Tom came up with the idea of starting a garage.
See, that was one of the things I had come up with when I was sitting at this company, speculating about the future. I had my feet up on the desk, and I put together all the different trends that I could see, and I said, you know what would be a great idea? A place where you could fix your own car, and people would have the tools for you. They'd have a lift you could put your car up on, all the tools that you would never buy yourself because you only needed them once, and they would have a roof over your head and someone to advise you. I said, what a great idea. And then I quit my job and became a bum and promptly forgot all about it.
So, Ray, when Tom had this idea of a do-it-yourself garage, did you like the idea? And were you involved with cars already?
I did. I was involved with cars.
Oh, he was a boy genius when it came to cars. My brother won the science fair with an invention for a new kind of engine, which is yet to be made until recently, I think. Maybe people have been thinking about it.
Right.
Right? Right. I mean, this kid was like 8 years old, and he developed a concept for a combination one cycle, two cycle, four cycle, eight cycle engine. I don't even know what it was.
It was brilliant.
It was brilliant. So, yeah, I mean, he was into it.
Oh, I want to.
By the way, Terry, we should tell you that we have made a concerted effort. We are making a concerted effort to not rant and rave.
Because, that's what you do in your book, yes.
You're such a calm person that we have purposely lowered the lights in the studio so that it will tone us down. And you may have noticed that we're even speaking a little bit more quietly.
And we haven't drunk any coffee at all today.
So if I do lose it once in a while, feel free to just remind me.
So you're trying to make that transition from the Car Talk vibe to the Fresh Air vibe.
To the Fresh, exactly.
Right.
I'm trying to honor the respect that you deserve. That's
right. There you go. Now, when you started the do-it-yourself garage, it seems to me the time must have really been right for that, because, for example, like in 1970, I think you started the garage in 73, and around 1970, I was tuning up my own car. I mean, that's how much people were into do-it-yourself.
Yeah.
Mechanics. That short-lived period in my life.
It was really an idea whose time had come. And it was...
unfortunately, it didn't stay.
It was one of those things that you couldn't make any money at it. And you know, it was a great concept, and we have never had as many laughs as we had the year that we that we opened that garage. I don't think I've ever had as many laughs as I had.
No, we had
year.
A rollicking good time.
What kind of laughs?
Belly laughs, because we attracted every kind of inept weirdo that the city of Cambridge and the surrounding towns had to offer.
Yeah, and there was no shortage.
There was no shortage, and I was amazed to find out how many wackos inhabited our fair city. And those who came in, who thought they knew what they were doing and didn't, really expected us to do the work for them for $2.50 an hour or whatever we were charging them. And we soon realized that we were doing all the work for everybody, running around like nuts, doing everyone's work while they were standing there paying $2.50 an hour, having professionals work on their cars. It even got so bad that we had to hire extra people to help out. And while we did make some money during the days before every major holiday, it was pretty much a bust.
Yeah.
And then we hadn't figured out that the good people of Cambridge were going to steal our tools and all that. So,
oh, did they do that?
Well, yeah. But what really drove us out of business was the fact that in 1973, fixing one's own car was within the grasp of the average person. But as emission controls came into being and cars got more complicated, it soon disappeared. That ability soon disappeared. And we found that the business diminished considerably. And people in the Cambridge who had the time, because they were unemployed bums like my brother, to work on their own cars, went out and got jobs and bought newer cars and fortunately, you know, took them to us to get them serviced.
But it's interesting how much fun the bums could be. I mean, these were complete wackos, weirdos, as my brother said. He's absolutely right. But man, were they fun. And they weren't worried, you know, when the guy jacked up his Lincoln Town Car and drove the floor jack through his oil pan. Did he cry? I said, "Uh-oh." I mean, people could take a joke. And people were not as uptight as they are now. You know, it was only a car.
Well, and you know what contributed to it too, that those people who were working on their cars weren't pressed for time. If they were, they wouldn't have time to work on their own cars.
Of course.
And what makes us frantic these days and unwilling to laugh at something that should be funny is that we're all so stressed out because we're running around trying to do too many things, and we don't have time to stand back and laugh at something that you should laugh at.
Yeah.
And we're too stressed out because we think of the consequence. Oh, my God, I put the jack through my oil pan, and now I can't laugh about it because I'm going to miss 5 days of work and this and that, and I'm going to be yelled at, and it's going to be a disaster instead of saying, boy, this is really funny. I should have a good laugh and think about the consequences later on.
And what was really sort of spiritual about it was that nobody ever got hurt. I mean, in all the years that we did that, with complete rank amateurs using very dangerous equipment.
Oh, like acetylene torches.
Oh,
and,
man. I mean, lifting
and we didn't
four
know.
Tons.
We really didn't know any better either. Hey, you want to use the torch? Yeah, go ahead. We'll be standing on the other side of the brick wall.
Wear this football helmet. Call us if anything happens. We're going out for coffee.
So when the do-it-yourself concept failed financially, why did you start a real garage after that?
Well, because we had a real garage, too. In the same building.
It was sort of a gradual transition. You know, in the beginning, all the customers were doing the work themselves, ostensibly. And little by little, we found ourselves doing more and more of it. And then people would come and say, gee, I really can't do this myself. Would you guys do it? So we had professionals working in side by side with amateurs. And it just so happened that the amateurs began to disappear, and the cars increased in number. And so it became just a plain old repair shop when all those crazy weirdos got jobs, I guess. I don't know where they are.
Yeah, some of them got sent back to the mothership.
Tom? Tom, were you doing mechanical work yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, for many years he did.
Now, I stopped doing it. many years ago because it was much too much like work. and I've been trying all my life to avoid, you know, real work. And that was, I mean, in the beginning, it was just so much fun that I didn't realize it was work. We were literally putting in 12, 14-hour days. And these were hard, hard days. I mean, I remember going home, plopping on the bed, falling asleep, waking up the next morning and dragging myself back to the shop. And
yeah, there weren't many days spent with your feet up on the desk.
Oh, man.
But it was fun.
When you guys started your garage, were your parents ever embarrassed to say, my sons are mechanics, as opposed to being able to say, my sons are teachers, my son is a marketing consultant?
They hung their heads in shame.
Well, they didn't really hang their heads in shame, I don't think. They just kept shaking their heads like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, we should mention you're both graduates of MIT.
Yeah.
How about Dad that? Worked his fingers to the bone to send us there. And when we told them that we were opening up an auto repair shop, their hearts sank. But they
took it like champs, you know. It's sort of like when my soon to be wife's mother met me. In fact, it was during this very time. I had been working in the garage all day, and she was coming into Boston from somewhere, and she was with her mother. So I went to, being a nice guy, I went to meet her at the airport so I could drive her home, and her mother was going to go on to New Hampshire where she lived. And it was one of these, they were overseas, and it was one of these fly-by-night airlines. And I get there at 10 o'clock when it's supposed to arrive, and I can't even find a terminal where anyone recognizes the name of this airline. And it turns out that it's going to be late, and it turns out it's going to be like 8 hours late. So I sleep on a bench in the airport. I've been there all night, never having had a chance to get home and take a shower. I'm wearing the greasy coveralls of the mechanic, and I've been sleeping in the airport all night. I've never met her mother. So finally, this trans international global airline thing lands, and out they come, and I stumble over there at 6 o'clock in the morning, and Joanne says to her mother, "This is Tom." She evidently had mentioned me, and her mother sort of looked at her and said, "I trust your judgment," and she walked away. What was that introduction to? I forgot.
oh, about your parents, you know.
Oh, and my parents were sort of in the same way. You know, what are your sons doing in the garage? You know, I trust their judgment.
Now, the first time you were on the radio, I think it was for a panel discussion on cars on WBUR, a Boston NPR affiliate. Were you relaxed that first time on radio? Did you feel like you sounded and behaved like yourselves?
Yeah, I think so, only because we didn't know that it was a real radio station. I mean, it's part of Boston University. And at the time, the studios, I mean, you'd think it was like 1920. And
the equipment resembled the tin cans and the string
right.
used as kids.
And you would expect Marconi to walk by any minute. And so our assumption was, you know, first of all, who's listening to this station? And we thought it was a station that only broadcast like on wires within the school, within BU.
Well, we thought it had, you know, 50-watt capacity, and then we found out it had 50,000 watts. Something.
Well, when they turned on the microphones, the lights dimmed. So, yeah, I think we were pretty relaxed.
When you started doing your own show on WBUR, before the show was national, back in the early days when you were first starting, how did you sound compared to how you sound now, do you think?
Well, it sounded surprisingly like the new shows do.
It did?
Yeah. I mean, we tended to, if we got someone on the line who we thought was interesting, we tended to talk to that person for whatever period of time we thought was appropriate, sometimes 25 minutes. And our producer, Doug Berman, would never allow that now. He's giving us the cut sign and waving his hands and jumping up and down. If we go more than 5 or 6 minutes, he gets nervous. But other than that, I would say the show was pretty much the same.
Really?
Which begs the question, why do we need bourbon? An egg timer would do, wouldn't it?
I've been asking that question from day one.
My guests are Tom and Ray Maliazzi, the hosts of NPR's Car Talk and authors of the book In Our Humble Opinion. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's hard to sum up what public radio does. One minute you're laughing with Tom and Ray, and another you're finding out about the latest international crisis from NPR's reporters. Your station keeps you informed and entertained, and that makes it worth the price of a pledge. So I hope you'll call now. Thank you. Let's get back to our interview with Tom and Ray Maliazzi, hosts of NPR's Car Talk and authors of the book In Our Humble Opinion. When you started on radio, did anyone ever say to you, Tom, Ray, you're laughing too much. You know, you have to be more serious. Tone it down.
No one ever told us anything. until maybe a week ago, mm-hmm. We would walk into the studio and say, are we on? I mean, we had absolutely no information. We knew the room we would go to. We knew where to sit, and that was it.
And
that's pretty much
the reason we knew that is there was a show on the hour before us called Shop Talk, which was two or three guys talking about stereo equipment.
Yeah.
And, you know, recording and the like. And we would watch them through the glass, and we would see how far away from the microphone they sat, and we noticed that they wore headphones. And we noticed that they pressed the lighted buttons on the phone to talk to callers. And so we patterned ourselves after what they did.
And I'm proud to say that after 23 or 4 years on the radio, we have learned absolutely nothing. I know, and it's absolutely the truth. I mean, people say, tell us about radio. We have no idea. We sit in front of the microphones here. We know nothing about radio. Nothing.
We've never made any attempt to learn anything either. And we do laugh a lot, too much sometimes, and I'm sure people complain. And there are
plenty.
Many people who can't stand us because...
My wife is one of them.
My brother laughs so much, especially... Right. Well, that goes without saying. Which wife?
All of them.
So when you started doing the radio show, did it change the business at the garage? Were more customers coming? Did they treat you differently because you were on the radio?
Well... One of the reasons that we did the radio show, we did it. I mean, when they asked us to continue doing it, we did it for no money. And why would we do that? And the only reason we did it was we were able to mention the name of our garage on the air. And that was the only reason we did it. And we did it until like a month ago for no money. As long as we could mention the name of the garage.
That's a real long month, that month ago.
Yeah. So we mentioned the name of the garage, and yes, business did pick up mm-hmm. because people mm-hmm. had heard of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the reason we initiated the puzzler on the show, because we asked people to send the answers to the puzzler to the garage.
Yeah, because they told us we could not plug the garage, so we devised this clever scheme of a puzzler. And then we said, and if you have an answer to the puzzle, you could go in a free oil change, mail it to, and we gave the name and address of the garage.
We don't mention the garage anymore.
No.
We never
mention it. Doesn't really exist.
We don't mention the name of it anymore.
No, it doesn't really exist anyway.
Well, it does, but you don't want to be plugging it shamelessly on the air now.
Exactly.
Unlike the earlier days when you did want to be plugging it shamelessly, but couldn't.
Right.
So you still have the garage. Ray, you still manage the garage. Tom, you don't really work at the garage anymore. So
I don't work at the garage. I decided that it was too much work, and I...
Plus, we have a restraining order.
I think it's 500 feet now. I can't go within 500 feet of the garage.
How have you each liked over the years having responsibility for a business, for making sure you make a profit, making sure the customers are treated okay, for having responsibility for employees?
Oh, I hate it. It's incredibly stressful.
No, that's part of the reason I left.
Mm-hmm.
It was horrible. And mm-hmm. it was horrible. I mean, we had to fire a guy once, and it broke my heart. Leo.
Yeah.
I mean, he was our buddy. And he was such a screw-up, it was unbelievable. And he was so unreliable, it was hopeless. And he even said, he came in one day and he said, I want you to fire me. And we couldn't do it. Because he was our pal. And Jerry,
yeah,
same thing.
Yeah, no, it's tough. And it's
horrible.
And it's tougher, however, I think, having responsibility for the customer's cars. Because you're responsible for people's... Well, first of all, you're responsible for people's safety. You have to make sure you put all the pieces back and their wheels don't fall off and their brakes work.
Well, I was just laughing at the memory of the one that you took real good care of. The one, the Nissan. The one that took the plunge.
I did have a car fall off the lift.
Oh, God.
One day, and I don't know how it happened. But
that's every
and the guys at the
nightmare.
Shop have never ever let me forget it. Every time a Nissan comes in, they ask, "Would you like us to put the thing up on the lift for you, or do you think you can handle it?"
How loud was it when it fell off the lift?
It was so loud that people from every surrounding building came running over to see what had happened, and I stood there and laughed and laughed. And the reason I laughed is, but for a few seconds, I would have been under this car when it fell off the lift because I had walked over to my toolbox to get a wrench. And as I turned around, I noticed that the car was at a peculiar angle and no longer parallel to the floor. And I said, And I didn't have much time to think about it. And 6 feet to zero happens very quickly.
Oh.
And within a wink of an eye, this car was on its side.
What did you say to her?
It was an interesting call.
It had to.
It was a fellow whose name I don't remember, who owned the car, and I told him that there had been an incident.
Yes, I would say so.
And his car had fallen off the lift, but again, I was giddy because I hadn't been under it. And I told him that. I said, "Look, we'll replace your car, or the insurance company will replace it, or whatever." But I'm just so happy that I wasn't crushed by your car. He was not amused.
He wasn't?
No.
Tom and Ray Maliazzi are the hosts of NPR's Car Talk and authors of the book In Our Humble Opinion. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You see that doll in that big green car?
Well, I saw my baby just another day in a big green car on the wide highway. I saw my baby with another man. I got a big man with a quiet can. I saw my baby, but what can I do? Just walking on along.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, saying goodbye to the beloved Dodge Dart. We continue our conversation with Tom and Ray Maliazzi, the hosts of NPR's Car Talk.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Dial Press Division, publisher of Paradise Park by Allegra Goodman, the author of Caterskill Falls. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom and Ray Maliazzi, the hosts of NPR's Car Talk. Listeners tune in not just for the information, but for the laughs. Tom and Ray also write a syndicated newspaper column and are the authors of the book In Our Humble Opinion. Now, a lot of people think of you as Tom and Ray, you know, and they're not always sure which is which. It's like Tom and Ray, they're the car guys. So let's talk a little bit about who you are both as individuals. There's 12 years age difference between the two of you. Tom, you're 12 years older than Ray. Were you close as kids? That's a really big gap when you're young.
Well, you know, in between is a sister. And she claims that she has no recollection of my little brother for the first, like, 15 years of his life. She claims that we were the only two siblings. And she said, where the heck did he come from? But, I mean, we were close if a 12-year-old can be close to a no-year-old, and a 20-year-old can be close to an 8-year-old.
I'm glad you got that right.
So I guess we were close because I remember him fairly well, you know?
Tom, did your mother make you take care of Ray?
I don't think so.
No, because
I thought it was fun.
Grandma lived with us.
Yeah.
Our mother's mother lived with us, and she took care of all of us for a time. It was her, I don't know if it was her responsibility, but or she just enjoyed it, but she took charge of us, and she was the one who, when she went to do the shopping, took the kids along and whatever. We don't know what Mom did.
Yeah.
What did she do?
Ray, did Tom bully you as the older brother, or was he too old to bother?
Oh, no, not at all. He was too old to bother, and we had a great relationship, but I do remember going places with him and his friends. You know, why a kid who was a senior in high school would want to take his little brother to the beach with them, I don't know, but I willingly and gladly went along.
Well, I have to let you know.
Oh.
They were paying me off.
I thought so.
I was making 20 bucks a week. Back then, that was big money.
Ray, did Tom expose you to things that your parents didn't know you were getting exposed to that they might not have been pleased about?
Like dangerous chemicals and the... No, not really. No.
No, I mean, the memories I have is I take my little brother to see in person the Three Stooges. Wow. Do you remember that?
I mean, I do remember.
Talk about memorable.
I remember it. You also took me to see Benny Goodman at Symphony Hall.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And he also used to leave me places, Terry. And that's how I learned my way around the subway system of our fair city.
Yeah.
You can get home from here. I don't want to.
Don't take it personally.
I'm only 9.
were either of you more sociable as kids?
Was one of us more sociable than the other, you mean?
Yes.
Beats me.
Geez, I don't know. I think Tommy was probably more sociable.
Yeah, but I mean, some of the happiest years of my life were high school.
All 6 years of them.
All 6 years of high school. So I don't know if that would be sociable, but it was a very sociable time.
Now, who taught each of you how to drive?
Dad.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, my father, when I was a kid, he had a very old, even then, 1932 Chevy. And I was fascinated with driving. I remember I was 11, 12 years old, and I was watching him all the time. And it wasn't a simple thing to do. I mean, there was clutch, brake, the starter was underneath the gas pedal. It was very confusing, and it wasn't like a modern car. And one quiet, beautiful Sunday, spring Sunday morning, we were driving down a street on the backside of Cambridge, was pretty deserted, and he turns to me. I'm 12 years old, and he says, "Do you want to drive?" I almost peed my pants. Man, I was so thrilled.
And to this day, he has the same reaction. Someone asks him if he wants to drive.
Well, I got behind the wheel, and I did it. I mean, it was amazing. I stalled it a couple of times, and I was actually able to drive. I was so thrilled, and from that moment on, I just couldn't wait to get my license, which led to another incident.
What?
Because one day, I figured he had let me drive, so I now was a driver, you know? And one day, we were getting ready to go on a little family outing. It was a Sunday morning. The car was parked in front of the house, and I decided I'm going to be a good guy. We were loading up the car with stuff. You know, we were going to the beach. And the door was open. And I decided I would start the car and warm it up for Dad. And the car happened to be in gear, and I forgot to step on the clutch. And so I
engaged, became a three-door, huh?
I engaged the starter. The car lurches forward, and the door falls off. I mean, it had these big iron hinges, and they just broke. And there's the door lying on the sidewalk, and I'm terrified. Man, I said, oh, my God. My father comes out of the house, and he says, door fell off. He got some clothesline, tied the door back on, and we went to the beach. He never said anything about it. The next day, he took it down to one of his buddies, and they welded the hinges back together. But it was the incident. It's sort of like dropping the car off the lift, you know?
Was your father always that relaxed about things?
I guess he was.
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, he was.
So, Ray, did you learn to...
He passed away a few months ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He was 93.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. My guests are Tom and Ray Malyatsi, the hosts of NPR's Car Talk and authors of the book In Our Humble Opinion. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Tom and Ray Malyatsi. You know them as the hosts of NPR's Car Talk. They also have a book called In Our Humble Opinion. What was your first fender bender?
Jeez, my first fender bender. I remember my first fender bender. It was with my dear friend Johnny Mellum, a friend of mine who had a car, and I was in college at the time, because in high school I was too young to drive a car. No, I was in high school. And he had come to my house in his car, and again, it involved a door. I'm bad with doors.
Evidently.
And he was pulled up alongside me somehow, and I didn't realize he was getting ready to leave, and I opened the door of my father's car. Johnny pulled away, and the door and his car met, and it was ugly. It was ugly.
Well, yeah. I don't remember my first accident, but I can tell you about my most recent accident.
It was this morning.
No, I had the great pleasure a few years ago of buying for myself from a customer who had melted the engine, a 1987 Dodge Colt Vista. And even then, which was 3 or 4 years ago, it was an old jalopy. And not that I'd always had nice cars, but I always tried to, even if I had an old car, keep it looking good or in good shape. But with this car...
I never took the trouble.
With this car, I decided that it was a jalopy from the start, and it was going to remain one. I wasn't going to fix the dents or the rust or anything.
And you realize how liberating that is.
It is unbelievably liberating. And my accident occurred one night as I was driving home from work. I was in Harvard Square, and a woman driving a Honda evidently wasn't paying attention and smashed into the back of my car, jarring, me out of the driver's seat almost. But I wasn't hurt. And instead of the usual where you'd get out of the car and exchange papers, I rolled down the window and stuck my head out, and I asked her, she was also driving a jalopy, if she was okay. And she said, yeah. And I just waved and said, see you later.
Forget about it.
And I drove off. And that's the first car I ever would have done that with. And it felt great. And I've
done that with every car I ever owned.
I didn't look until days later.
It didn't matter.
I realized that she had ruined my car. No, and it didn't matter. Isn't it crazy that we have cars that are all shiny and polished and ripple-free and dent-free, and we have to worry about them? You buy a new car, you can't go to the parking lot for 6 months afraid that someone's going to dent your door.
Well, were you ever that way with a car?
Yes, I was once that way with every car. And I realized one day how stupid it is.
It's only a car.
It's only a car. It's absolutely nuts. And I think we there are certainly more important things to do with our time and our lives.
Like
and
fixing
our
cars.
Well, whatever. But, there are certainly more things to be concerned about than the finish on your car.
Do you both drive old and new cars now?
Well, we drive new cars because we kind of have to, because we should be up to date on what's going on.
We test drive a lot of new cars.
So we test drive cars.
But our wives own newer cars. They wouldn't be seen dead in the things that we drive. Tommy owns a really old car.
Yeah, and I've always believed in old cars, and my wife started to get really angry at me because we always had old cars, and they always made noises and things broke, and she said, I'm driving little babies around, and can't we get a little better car? And I didn't know what she was talking about because the cars were perfect as far as I could tell. You need all those doors? I mean, come on.
Do all the brakes have to work at the same time?
I mean, come on. You don't need all that stuff. And she kept saying to me, well, you can live with it because when it breaks down, you get out and you fix something and it keeps going. She said, but what about the little babies that we're carrying around? I said, whose babies are they anyway? It turned out they were mine. So I finally relented. And
that baby argument always works.
Oh, man.
It's a killer.
It's powerful.
Well, Tom, your prized Dodge Dart was, I think, totaled in a collision while your son was driving.
Yeah. He wasn't responsible. He was sitting at a traffic light, and some complete bozo from the town of Arlington, Massachusetts, driving a snowplow, testing his brakes on one of the most busy streets in the town, decides to step on the brake and they don't work. And he plowed literally into the back of the dear old Dodge Dart.
He was driving a plow, huh?
He was driving a plow and plowed into the Dodge Dart. And unfortunately, it was terminal.
For the car. Was your son hurt?
Nobody was hurt, luckily. Good. And if I had found the driver of that truck, he'd be hurt.
Wow. Because, you were so in love with that car?
Well, I mean, it was so irresponsible to test the brakes of a 10-ton truck on a major street. To test the brakes? Duh! I mean, how dumb can you be? Whoever you are out there, you're dumb.
How sorry were you to lose that Dodge Dart?
It was horrible.
What year was it? 63
or
something?
I was devastated.
63.
It was a 63 Dodge Dart.
Well, actually, it was a 60, 61, 62, 63. It had parts from a lot of different cars. But there was a lengthy period of mourning, Terry.
There was. Because it was a dear old friend. I had bought it as an interim car. All my cars have been interim cars. My brother keeps telling me, well, it's only an interim car. Buy an interim car. So I bought it as an interim car. And it was one of those, after a period of time, I realized I was in love with it. Because it asked so little of me, it gave so much to me, and it was ugly as sin. Ugly, man, but ugly. people got paid to design that car.
Well, it was from a different time.
I mean, it was a convertible, but of course the top didn't work. You had to get in the back seat and pull it up by hand. And it was great.
That meant the top spent the entire summer in the down position. You can imagine what that meant.
And, you know, and it was so great because, you know, if it rained, so what? It got wet, but what was going to happen? It got wet. Big deal.
So you guys drive old cars and new cars. What do you like most about the new stuff on the new cars, and what do you find most pointless?
Boy, oh boy. What do we like most about the new cars? Well, I guess they're safer.
And they handle better, even the cheapest of the newer cars. I mean, you can buy a Hyundai Accent, which is, I don't know, $7,000 or something. And it handles better than any car my brother has ever owned.
That's an absolute truth.
And it stops better. I mean, modern cars handle great. They stop wonderfully. And they are safer. I mean, I don't think I'd want to be hit broadside driving a Hyundai Accent if I could have a choice of driving a 56 Buick.
Or a 63 Dodge Dart, even.
Or a 63 Dodge Dart. Yeah. But a head-on collision, I'd rather be driving the Accent because I think you have a better chance than those older cars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I hate about the newer cars, we don't have enough time.
That's a lot longer list.
Well, I hate the complexity of the controls. You remember the old days when you had a car like a 63 Dart and you wanted to turn on the defroster? And you wanted the defroster to blow warm air, you push two levers all the way to the right, and then at the same time you could, if you were deft enough, you could also hit the fan switch,
which was part of one of those levers, maybe,
or was just above it.
Simple.
So in one fell swoop, you could turn the defroster on to max heat and full fan output, without having to take your eyes off the road.
Right.
And you know what? That was good enough, and it still is. And why manufacturers make cars where you have to take your eyes off the road to look at a touch screen to control things like the heat and the radio, I'll never understand. It's bad enough we have all these distractions from cell phones and the like. We have cup holders in cars which allow you to have a 9-course meal. Pretty soon they're going to be putting tray tables in.
And stewardesses.
Do you?
Yeah, it's unconscionable.
Do you spend a lot of time together when you're not on the air? Do you like hang out together a lot?
God,
I can't stand them.
Only if he's buying.
Well, do you?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Can't get rid of them.
What do you do together?
We eat mostly. You know, it's funny. We've gotten to this strange point where the only way that we can socialize is to eat.
It's an Italian thing.
Is it?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, what we do, food is involved.
Well, food is pretty important.
Nah.
Oh, sure.
It's like cars. It's
try going without food for a week.
But we've made it so important. At least this is the story my wife tells me. She says, food is not that important. This business of 3 squares a day, forget about it.
Well, we could do other things, but whenever I try to get my brother, for example, to appreciate nature, we were in San Francisco a few years ago, and I managed to lure him out of the hotel to go for a walk in the Muir Woods.
Espresso macchiato in the cafe.
Right. So I tell him they have espresso macchiato.
In the Muir Woods. He lied to me.
And he cried and moaned the whole time. We were there for about 2 hours.
Have you been there, Terry?
I have, actually.
It's breathtakingly beautiful.
Here's what
it?
Happens. We drive there. And just the drive there was, I thought, pleasant enough. Then we park in the parking lot. And then there's this long walk where you're walking under these monstrous trees. And what are those, anyway? Sequoias?
Redwoods. And
Redwoods.
The walkway is paved.
The walkway is paved.
People in wheelchairs can access it.
Exactly. So you walk down to the end of this thing, which is, a couple of hundred yards. I mean, it's a long way. And what that does is it brings you to the entrance to the trails.
At which point my brother says, okay, that's enough. Let's turn around and go back to the hotel.
I walked to the end of the thing. And I said, that was great.
Where's the espresso?
And I turn around to leave. And he says, no. 4 hours later, we're trudging through. Who knows what we're trudging through. And what am I seeing?
Fighting off dinosaurs.
Carbon copies of the very same trees that I had seen on the first 100 yards.
You're just a Yahoo. And there's no... I mean, you couldn't for a moment stand there and appreciate the serenity and the uniqueness of every tree.
I did do that. I stood there. I appreciated the serenity, and it was time to go back to the city.
One last question. You're both most famous for cars. You must drive a lot. And yet, from what I understand, you don't leave home very much. You don't go very far from home, in spite of all the cars that you have. Is that right? And why do you not like to go far?
Well, I can speak quickly on that one. I've already been every place, and B, I hate airplanes, airlines, airports, and everyone remotely associated with the airline or transportation industry. Does that cover it?
Don't hold anything back.
So yeah, you're right. I hang around.
I on the other hand travel. I haven't of late traveled, but we've. You know, we've made the obligatory trip to Europe, and we've seen the entire of the 48 states, I think.
And every goddamn tree. Get this. He comes back from one of his wonderful trips out west, where he rents a car and drives around for 100 days. I don't know. And he gets back, and he says, hey, want to see the videotapes of the trip?
I had 200 hours of raw videotape filmed through the windshield.
Filmed through the windshield of his car. Trees through the windshield of his car, in many cases with the windshield wipers. And so 10 of us are sitting there in front of the TV watching windshield wipers go back and forth, looking out the windshield. That's his idea of a good time.
Well, thanks so much for coming.
Larry, it's a pleasure.
Really enjoyed talking with you.
You're a wonderful person.
Thanks for inviting us.
Tom and Ray Maliazzi are the hosts of NPR's Car Talk and authors of the book In Our Humble Opinion. This is Fresh Air. If you enjoy NPR programs like Fresh Air and Car Talk, keep this in mind. Your station has to pay a fee to carry NPR programs. And during this fundraiser, your station needs your pledge in order to pay that fee. So remember, there's a direct correlation between your pledge and your station's ability to bring you the NPR programs you enjoy. Thank you for your support. The creators of the animated TV series South Park have a new series premiering tonight on Comedy Central. It's a live-action sitcom about life in the White House and stars Timothy Bottoms as President George W. Bush. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
I better start out by explaining where I stand on South Park. That's the Comedy Central series, and recently the movie, about a bunch of grade school students. It's crudely drawn, and it's crude, period. Lots of insults, bizarre situations, bleeped obscenities, and outrageous characters. Usually, I'm not big on raw crude. WWF SmackDown on UPN strikes me as a colossal waste of time. Son of the Beach, the FX cable network's Baywatch parody produced by Howard Stern, is too dumb to watch, even though if a program ever existed to be ridiculed, it's Baywatch. But South Park I like. There are ideas behind the misbehavior, and creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone attack pop culture like a cartoon Mad Magazine run amok. Somehow, they find ways to pick on everyone from Brian Boitano to Saddam Hussein and make it work. Plus, their show features the funniest musical interludes this side of The Simpsons. So I came to the new Parker and Stone series with high expectations. The time definitely is right for political satire in a weekly series. Saturday Night Live, after all, did its best work in years lampooning Bush and Al Gore during the never-ending presidential campaign last fall. And when Timothy Bottoms was cast as George W. Bush, it sounded like a sure thing. A generation ago, Bottoms starred as the earnest young Texas hero of The Last Picture Show. Now, as a middle-aged man, he not only has the accent down, he looks uncannily like the real George W. Bush. In addition to Bottoms as the president, this new sitcom stars Carrie Quinn Dolan as the First Lady, Kurt Fuller as Carl Rove, and Marsha Wallace from The Bob Newhart Show as a sassy housekeeper. It also features Kristen Miller as a beautiful but dumb secretary, and John DeCino as a goofy White House neighbor. All standard sitcom staples. The problem, though, is that Parker and Stone are much more interested in making fun of sitcoms than of politics. Their series, which launches tonight on Comedy Central, is called That's My Bush, and it's full of standard jokes and rejoinders and risque remarks. And while I initially thought the studio audience was playing along and acting like one of those rude crowds from Married with Children, it turns out there is no audience. Just Parker and Stone fiddling with the soundtrack in post-production and adding loud laughter after every joke and even rude sounds whenever the secretary says anything or walks anywhere. To say that this gets old fast is an understatement.
My fellow Americans, this week I plan to unite our country and bring both sides of the abortion issue together in a historic summit. Abortion is a very serious, very personal issue. And let me assure all of you that tonight you promised to have dinner with Laura. I mean, let me assure all of you that I'll do my best. Good night.
Laura, you have to stop putting reminder messages to me in the teleprompter.
I just don't want you to forget our dinner plans, and you don't have time to talk to me.
I'm talking to you now.
All right, fine. I was thinking...
Mr. President! Mr. President, I was reviewing your schedule on my Palm Pilot and realized you only have 10 minutes to save the Earth from the Xinthians.
That's not a Palm Pilot, Princess. That's a Game Boy.
Wait, then what's this?
That's a cheeseburger. Come on, Princess. Let's have another review session.
In theory, I still like the idea for That's My Bush. I like that plots involve federal executions and abortion debate summits instead of forgotten anniversaries and poorly cooked dinners. And when Fuller's Rove, in next week's show, launches a diatribe against improv comedy, I liked that too. Unfortunately, it was the only time I laughed during the two episodes I previewed. Making fun of sitcoms is one thing, but if you're going to do it, you ought to at least make sure you're funnier than the comedies you're ridiculing.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we get the latest on migraines and migraine medicine from Dr. Fred Cheftel, director and founder of the New England Center for Headache and chair of the World Headache Alliance. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.